More people every day are ditching animal products, embracing plant-based foods, and speaking up for what matters. With my experience as an international instructor for vegan nutrition and an award-winning author, I interview experts, innovators, and celebrities about the global movement towards a plant-based future. Do you want to learn how to combat the injustice in our food system affecting your health, the animals, and the planet? Well, you're in the right place. It all starts here with Eating Like You Give a Damn. Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Eating Like You Give a Damn show, the place to discover your passion for plant-based living one bite at a time. I'm your host, Stephanie Harder. So first, I want to welcome all of the viewers that are here right now live with us on Facebook. So throw us a high five emoji to say hello. This episode is brought to you by Foundation to Freedom. Foundation to Freedom is the business accelerator school for vegan, vegetarian, and plant-based coaches to learn how to earn a full-time income while making a big impact for people, animals, and the planet. Head over to eatinglikeyougiveadamn.com to watch my free training on how to finally make the income, influence, and impact you really want to make as a plant-powered coach or consultant. Now, let's dig in with today's super cool guest, because today we're chatting with food freedom leader Katie Papo, who coaches compulsive overeaters through an accelerated system to end binge eating at the root level, even if they've already struggled for decades and nothing has worked. After recovering from 10 years of binge eating and compulsive over-exercising, Katie has taught more than 2,000 people from around the world. She turns conventional methodologies on their heads, proving that any committed and coachable individual can break the binge habit. Welcome, Katie. It's so exciting to have you here on the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, man, it's great to have you. So let's go ahead and start from the very beginning, shall we? Because what we really love to hear at the start of the show is what your vegan story is. You know, how did you find yourself on this path to becoming vegan? And what's the backstory behind that? What did you used to think about health? What did you used to think about animals? How was your lifestyle? And then what was that thing that caused you to make that shift?
Sure. Yeah. So when I was in college, I started practicing yoga. And one of the core principles of yoga is nonviolence. And while this is not even, it was not even part of my understanding that eating animals was violent. When I would order something from a restaurant or from a fast food place, it never even occurred to me really that what I was eating was an animal who had been through violence. And I started, just by doing yoga, I started becoming more attracted to that. I started dabbling with vegetarianism. I was vegetarian for a few years. And then what I really didn't want to give up was cheese, because cheese was something I was eating at every single meal. I could not imagine my world without cheese. What would I even eat if I wasn't eating cheese? How would anything taste good if I didn't put cheese on it? And then I had a friend who said, "Hey, you ready to go vegan?" And I was like, "Sure." Not really believing that that would happen. But he showed me this video, which was kind of my aha moment, called The Best Speech Ever by Gary Yourofsky, which is available on YouTube. Amazing presentation and really dynamic speaker. And what he talked about, which got me, was the dairy industry and what happens to the calves who are separated from their mothers and the mothers who are separated from their babies. And I realized that in order for me to eat cheese, I was separating families. And that for me was just enough. So for me, the transition to veganism was not even remotely related to health. It was entirely based on the principle of I did not want to cause any more violence or stress or harm to any family or any individual, human or non-human.
Wow. So then what exactly was your relationship with animals growing up? Because it sounds to me like you probably already, you know, had, you know, experienced maybe a level of empathy for animals, because not everybody really experiences that. Not everybody grows up with animals and has some sort of a connection to them, right? So what was your upbringing like around animals?
Yeah, so we never had pets really growing up. I had a goldfish that I won at a carnival, and that was the extent of pets in our home. And I did feel very close to that goldfish, but really I wasn't around it. I just wasn't around animals, and I loved them, and I loved visiting friends' houses when they had dogs, and that was always really fun. I always wanted a dog. My parents always said no. So really my relationship with animals was more of like pets and animals that you see at a zoo. And I never even thought of them as individuals, let alone, you know, anything beyond entertainment for humans.
Right. Interesting. So then it was really that speech by Gary Yourofsky that sort of like flipped a switch for you?
Yes. He basically showed a whole different world where animals are their own individual people, so to speak. And they have families and they have thoughts and they have feelings and they have wants and needs and they can feel happiness and they can feel pain just like we can.
Gotcha. Wow. And I know I've seen that speech. I know when I was living over in Italy for a few years while my husband was an MA in the military, I was just starting down that path. He and I had, you know, in 2009, just started down that path of, you know, really looking at our food choices in a very, very different way. And it all started with a book for me, but, you know, I couldn't really finish the book. Once I got to all those parts in the book that really spoke the truth and gave me that visual about what happens to these animals, I, you know, immediately had this emotional connection to that. But that sent me also into a little bit of a depression for a while. But it was when I came across that speech by Gary that that both my husband and I, we were just like, wow, this doesn't make sense for us. I mean, we love our pets at home. We love, you know, seeing animals in nature. You know, just doesn't make sense for us. And that was that emotional shift that we got from that powerful speech too. So I can totally relate to you on that there. And then, of course, experiencing, you know, a lot of the health benefits that kind of came along with that. So it was a nice byproduct for me and my family. Did you feel that same experience too?
When I first went vegan, I was not a health food vegan. I was still very much a junk food vegan. And back then, there weren't as many junk food vegan options. Like, they didn't come out yet with the Ben and Jerry's vegan ice cream or all the amazing cheeses that are out now. So because of that, I had to sort of naturally move into healthier foods like fruits and vegetables. They were not a huge part of my diet before, but I started bringing them in. And once I started doing that, that's when I felt a major difference, because I was cooking a lot more for myself, buying a lot less processed foods. And once I started doing that and feeling better, then I felt a lot less attracted to the processed stuff anyway.
Yeah. I totally understand that too. We pretty much started down that same sort of a path. So I can relate to you on that, where, you know, we didn't have all of these amazing options that everyone has today when they're starting to implement these vegan choices, you know, the Beyond Burgers, the Impossible Burgers, you know, the fake chickens and, you know, all of that stuff, especially like the cheeses right now, right? We didn't have all of that stuff back then, but once we actually moved back from Italy to the States, we sort of went on a smorgasbord, because it was like, oh my God, we didn't have all this over there. So yeah, we ended up really loving all of that stuff. And so we, you know, since then it was just kind of a roller coaster for us, but then we found ourselves on a really healthy path and finding that balance between, you know, whole fruits and vegetables and grains and legumes and nuts and seeds and all that great stuff. And then, you know, having an occasional treat that really made us feel good. So now I'd really love to peel back more of your story about what your specialty is in. So tell us a little bit more of the background there as far as what your relationship was with food, as far as binge eating and over-exercising is concerned.
Sure. So when I was a teenager, I was not a very happy teenager, and I had a lot of emotional turmoil. And my habit that I created for myself was I would come home from school and I would put about 20 pizza rolls, these little pizza pockets on a plate, put it in the microwave. And then I would basically just zone out and eat and numb myself with food. And this became a regular habit. And then I found that anytime I was experiencing some kind of emotional turmoil, I would turn to food for that numbing effect. And eventually what that ended up turning into was I was using it for any emotion, happiness, sadness, anger, stress, really anything. And food was the only way really that I had to cope with those things. So it ended up being a pretty detrimental cycle because at a certain point I started gaining weight and I didn't like that. So first what I tried to do was over-exercise. So if I knew that I was going to eat a lot later, or if I had already eaten a lot, my first thing was I need to burn this off. And that ended up turning into an over-exercising habit. And what eventually happened was I over-exercised to the point of injury. And then I was really faced with, okay, you have an eating problem. You need to fix this because now you can't over-exercise. And if you don't fix it, then you will keep gaining weight and gaining weight and gaining weight. So what I started to do was look at food from a completely different new angle, because a lot of my methodology before was dieting, restricting, making food rules for myself to not eat past a certain time or not to eat certain foods or to only eat this, this, and this. And what the restriction ended up doing was making everything worse, because I would restrict and I could do it for a certain point, and then I would fall off the wagon, break a rule. And then I would say, well, screw it. I've already messed it up. So might as well eat all of the things that I want to have today, because I'm going to start on my meal plan again tomorrow. And then tomorrow, the same cycle would happen. So I would find myself every single day saying, tomorrow will be better. Tomorrow is when I'll start. So I ended up binging every single night with this idea in my head, well, I have to get it all in now because tomorrow I'm going to be restricting again. And this just went on for years and years and years.
Wow. I got to tell you, Katie, you know, a lot of what you're saying there actually resonates with me a little bit, because I found myself on cycles, especially through, you know, most of my 20s before I actually kind of came around to this whole, you know, being vegan and really caring about my health as kind of a byproduct of heading in that direction in the first place. But I can tell you, like, I've experienced moments of that where when I started realizing that all the exercising that I was doing when I was practicing martial arts, you know, in my mind, I was telling myself that that was my permission to be able to eat what I wanted, how often I wanted, however much I wanted. And, you know, I would just exercise it off later. And I would find myself in those moments where if I was experiencing something particularly emotional, you know, like you were talking about, whether it's, you know, whether it was happiness, sadness, whatever, you know, depression, whatever it was, I would turn to food. I've had moments like that. And you know what? And now that I'm talking about it, to be quite honest, I feel like sometimes I still have those moments. So since I can relate, I'm wondering, you know, who all can possibly relate to this? Like, you know, who generally experiences this problem? Is it, you know, a certain gender? Is it a certain lifestyle, a certain culture? Who experiences this type of stuff?
Yeah. So I think that when it comes to compulsive overeating as a chronic issue, so I think I'm going to acknowledge what you said in that. I think everyone can relate on this in some level. Like, for example, right now with the virus, everyone's in this feeling of uncertainty. So what do we want when we feel uncertainty? All we want is comfort. And food is one of these primal comforts that we can get. So people, even without eating disorders, are experiencing some level of this, of eating for comfort or out of boredom, something like that. What we found is that when it gets to the point of doing this over and over and over and over, and then feeling like it's piling on top of you, that you're trapped in this cycle, that's when it becomes a real issue and starts to affect all these other areas of your life. So what we found is that the people who struggle most are usually women, because most of the dieting industry does target women. And women tend to be the ones who are going on these diets over and over. And what we found is that dieting is actually the biggest cause of binge eating because of the heavy restrictions. So think about somebody who's put on a diet at, you know, maybe 12 years old. A lot of our clients started dieting when they were as young as 9 or into their teenage years because of their mothers putting them on diets. So then they grow up always on diets, but because they're not working or they work for this very short time, but then they gain the weight back plus more, then they say, well, maybe that wasn't the right diet. So then starts again the cycle on a new diet, but it's still restrictions. So it's still triggering binge eating. So what ends up happening is in the beginning, when somebody first starts a diet, as they can go maybe 3 months, 6 months, maybe even a year on that diet. But then eventually there's going to be a point where it's not sustainable anymore, because who wants to live in a world of restrictions? It makes your world very small. And so at that point, then the binge eating starts, the weight gain comes back, and then the next diet, and it becomes this cycle. So most of the women who we work with have been struggling for decades, people in their 40s, 50s, sometimes 60s, who have been living with this, you know, their entire life and have been so stuck and programmed in this diet mentality that they don't see a way out.
Gotcha. Wow. So I'm very curious to know if this is sort of related to, you know, I mean, most of us typically know what anorexia and what bulimia looks like. Is this another way to look at those particular issues there?
Yeah, this is basically a different side of the same coin. So it's a form of trying to control all of it. And with binge eating, binge eating is actually it's talked about significantly less than bulimia or anorexia. And there's a lot of shame and a lot of guilt around binge eating, because a lot of the women who struggle with binge eating disorder wouldn't even classify it as a disorder. They would classify it as, oh, I just don't have willpower. Oh, I just don't have motivation. Oh, I must just be weak-minded. Which doesn't make sense, because the women who we work with are wildly successful in other areas of their life, maybe financially, professionally, with relationships, but it's this one thing, it's this relationship with food that keeps holding them back from really embracing their entire life, because it's consuming so much of their thoughts and their energy and their time and their money. So what we found is that when it comes to the bulimia and anorexia, there's a lot more resources out there. It's a lot more openly talked about, whereas binge eating is rarely talked about. Most of the people who we work with, their husbands don't even know the extent that they're suffering.
Gotcha. So then how long do you think that this has been a problem for, you know, women who are facing this, you know, whether it's binge eating, yo-yo dieting, you know, whatever that relationship is with food, when did this all start in our society?
It seems like it started with diets, because diets are definitely the number one cause of binge eating. Restriction is the number one cause of binge eating. And so as long as we're going to be perpetually on diets, binge eating will happen. And what we found is that it starts a new cycle, especially between mothers and daughters, sometimes mothers and sons or fathers and sons. It's not gender exclusive. This is just really the people who come to us seeking help. So these are the stories we always hear. But a lot of times mothers will come and say, I noticed that my daughter has the same eating habits as me. It's not as bad as I am. And they try to hide it so their daughters don't pick it up. The kids are sponges. So I think that a lot of this cycle can be stopped actually between the relationship between mother and daughter, because when the mother learns how to eat normally and learns how to view food in a balanced and healthy way, then the daughter picks that up. And then we can start to break this cycle.
Gotcha. So you sound like you're on a mission to break the cycle, you know, like that happens generationally, right? Passed on from, you know, from mom to child. So, where exactly do people typically look for a solution when they understand that they have a problem like this? Because I'm assuming that they're probably not just going to, you know, Google how to end binge eating. How do they even self-diagnose? How do they know that they have an issue?
Most people know that something's wrong, because they'll sit at dinner with, let's say, friends, and the friends will take, you know, they'll eat half their food and then say, I'm good. And then they'll push it away. Whereas someone who's binge eating will think, how can you just not finish? How can you be satisfied? How can you even do that? So there's something that clicks that says this isn't normal, because it is this out of control feeling. And especially when it's a habitual habit every single night, then it it's clear that there's a problem. But I think a lot of women misdiagnose themselves by just saying, I just don't have willpower, or I just love food so much. Whereas it's not about the love for food, because usually when you're binge eating, you're numbing. So you're not even enjoying the food, or you're not even, you know, taking the time. And usually it's actually quite rushed. So there's something to be said for diagnosing it yourself, but really I don't even think a real diagnosis even needs to be given, because if you know that food is a suffering point for you in your life, then think about how that relationship's going to affect everything else in your life, because you're eating at least 3 times a day. So if you have a dysfunctional relationship with anything 3 times a day or more, then it's going to start affecting everything else. So what we found is women who are obsessed with food, their thoughts are so preoccupied that they might be outside playing with their kids, but where their mind is at, they're thinking, what am I going to eat later? What if I get hungry and I don't have this? How many calories is this? How many carbs is this? And they're calculating or obsessing in their brains, whereas they're not even in the present moment with what they're doing. So that's usually a red flag for people that they tend to notice right off the bat. And then usually the first thing that people will try after they've realized that diets don't work is therapy. And what we found is most of our clients have tried years of therapy before finding us. And the general consensus, and I can say as somebody who's done therapy as well, is that you do get more clarity over why you binge and what the triggers are. However, it doesn't shift the behavior itself. It's kind of like, you know, if you've got your kitchen garbage can is full and there's something smelly in there, therapy will kind of help you sift through the garbage and figure out which piece of garbage is causing the smell, right? But actually shifting out of it, it's the process of just not even analyzing. You just take the garbage out to the curb. That's what most people want to do. They don't want to sit and try to analyze what's smelly, because it still doesn't get rid of the smell.
Right.
So that's what we found that happens with people with therapy. And after therapy doesn't work, most people will either try something like weight loss surgery, maybe residential treatment, or what we found with most people is they actually don't believe that there's a way out. There's a huge belief, especially in the mental health community, that this is a mental illness, that it can only be managed, it cannot be fixed. So most people just believe that this is the life that they're destined to live. So they just try to manage their weight, which is through more dieting, which brings them deeper into the cycle.
Right. Wow. So, and I know that we're leading our way into a solution here with you, Katie, but I'm really like wanting to know more of the consequences. So the woman that's really suffering, the woman that's constantly thinking about her next meal and what she's going to consume, and, you know, what does that really do to her life? What are the real consequences there?
It can affect every area of life. So it can affect the relationship with the spouse, firstly, which is a huge one, because there's a lot of secrecy when it comes to binge eating. So a lot of times it might look like waiting for the husband or the kids to go to bed, so that way you can eat what you really want and finally have that alone time. And the alone time looks like lots of eating. It can also affect people professionally, because when you're binge eating or you have this secret or this shame, it's going to dramatically affect your confidence, especially if there's weight piled on top of that. Forbes, I remember, did a study that showed that overweight people are actually passed over for promotions a lot more, or that people don't even feel confident to even seek that promotion or to get paid what they're worth, because they don't want to be seen. It's a lot of hiding surrounding binge eating. So this might prevent people from wanting to go to network events. If someone's starting a business, they might not want to put themselves out there on video. It's all these different things. We even work with a lot of nutritionists, dietitians, and health coaches who struggle with their own eating disorders, and they feel out of integrity with their jobs and feel like they can't really self-promote with their whole hearts because they're suffering silently and privately and secretly. And then it also affects people on a major scale financially. And this is actually a piece that a lot of people don't even know about, because a lot of times when we binge, it looks like, oh, I'm just spending $10 here, $15 here, $20 here. But what we found is that over the course of a year, most women will spend between $5,000 to $15,000 on just food alone that they don't want to be eating. That doesn't even include programs that they've tried, meal plans that they've tried, supplements, shakes, you know, all that type of stuff as well, gym memberships. So really it affects the family financially in a huge way, which most people don't realize. But as, you know, $5,000 compounds over 5 years, that's $25,000 that could have gone to something that actually really is meaningful to them. So it affects your energy, it affects your time, it affects your relationships and your ability to show up in the world, and also, of course, financially.
Yeah, yeah, it really does touch every area of life. Wow, that's powerful. So then what are some tips or some guidelines for listeners that may be resonating with this message, that may be kind of like self-enrolling themselves and saying, hey, this really sounds like me. I identify that I have a problem here. Katie, tell me what I need to do. What could I be doing right now to help end this cycle?
The first thing is it has to happen is you need to get real clarity over what's happening, which is a really tough step for a lot of people, because what that means is you have to take yourself out of the numbing for a second. And it can be difficult actually to look at how this is truly affecting your life, and also what it looks like, even just the binge eating itself, because a lot of people, like I said, will just say, oh, well, I just, you know, love food. But asking yourself, is that true? A lot of times then we see, well, it's not really about the love for food. Really, it's about something completely different. Because if you really loved food, then you would, right, wait till you're hungry, because that's when food tastes best. Or you would stop when you're full, because food doesn't taste good if you're causing yourself pain. So the first step is really to give yourself a good look at what's actually going on, which can be a very difficult step for people, but it's 100% necessary. And then once you're really clear on what the actual problem is, then you can take steps to solve it. So for people who are struggling because they've been dieting their whole life, their problem might be different than somebody who only purely struggles when it's emotional or stress related. Mm-hmm. So we have to get really clear on what the actual problem is. But one thing across the board that works for everyone, not on its own, but as a core shift, is to release the restrictions completely around food. And releasing the restrictions for somebody who has been stuck in binge eating for so long is the most terrifying thing you can say to a person. Because then it's, well, if I don't have any restrictions, then I'm just going to be completely out of control. And then I'm never going to reach my goals. So it's that, along with, you know, professional help, that's really going to help. But that idea of releasing the restrictions needs to be understood first, because you can't end binge eating and be on a diet at the same time.
Gotcha. Okay. And then what does life look like at the other end of that rainbow? So when they do get that clarity, when they do learn how to, how to get the tools to be able to manage the way that they handle food, the way they make decisions about what to eat and when to eat. So what does that look like for them on the other side of that?
Yeah. And it's a great question, because a lot of our clients, when they first come to us, when we ask them what their vision is for themselves, they say, I just want to be normal. And then the question comes, well, what does normal even look like? And what normal eating looks like is there's no obsession. You eat when you're hungry. You enjoy your food. You allow yourself to eat whatever food you want. And what it feels like is trust. Because as long as there's a lack of trust, then you're always going to turn to some kind of external rule. So really what it looks like is actually understanding what your body's saying, being able to listen and trust it, versus trusting the mind that's just going to put rule after rule after rule. So really what ends up happening when you're free is your decisions are actually your decisions. You're not making decisions anymore based on compulsion or based on rebelling against a rule. You're making empowered decisions based on what actually serves you. And so then you have all this free mental space to actually focus on the things that you actually want to focus on. You have all this free time. Your finances are freed up big time. So now you can really put all of your energy and all of your resources into the things that actually matter to you in your life.
Yeah. Wow. That's really powerful. Now, I'm curious to hear too about how you found your way into this role. I mean, I know that you've had your personal experience, right? But so many people will have a powerful experience and not really necessarily follow it as though it's a calling to help others through the same sort of struggles. How did you answer that calling?
So I used to work in the weight loss world, and I was the director of a weight loss resort program. And what I found is that it worked for some people, but then there was a whole demographic of people who would do quote unquote really, really well. And then they would just fall off and then revert back to the old habits. And this was actually my mom also. I saw my mom my entire life. She was on diets for as long as I can remember. They got more and more severe and restrictive as she got older because of, you know, nothing would work. So then she started going to medical diets, medical nutritionists, where there was very, very severe restriction. And she was a perfectionist, is a perfectionist. She would do everything perfectly. And then after it was over, then all the weight would pile back on because the old habits were the same. That was really hard for me to watch as a daughter. And it's hard to see the people who you love suffer. And so when I fixed this myself, I always had her in mind. I always wanted to help her. That's why I got into weight loss in the first place, was because I thought the problem was just the weight. And I thought the problem was just, oh, you need to just know what to eat. You need to just know what's healthy. You need to know how to exercise. But really, that doesn't solve this problem. It solves a lot of other problems, but not this one. So I really wanted to help her. So now, I think the reason why it became my calling is because it was always my calling to help people like her, but back then I just didn't know how. Once I was able to solve it myself and then, you know, work with people, you know, developing as we go, getting the feedback, and now we've gotten to the point where it's very predictable. It used to be more of a guessing game. Now it's more predictable, where we actually can say, this is the process that you need to take. This is the level of practice that you need to do. And this is the type of support that you need. Now we know the formula. Before that, I was trying to access my calling in a different way, in a way that wasn't working for this specific population. Now we work only with this population because I feel that they are the most underserved.
Katie, I can only imagine you probably are, you know, working with women who have been suffering, you know, with this for 20, 30, maybe what, 40 years. So this is really, really amazing to see what you're doing and how you're able to help, you know, transform lives. And the fact that it all started with wanting to help your mom, I got to tell you, I can relate to that too. That's why I started as a health coach. And then now I've transitioned since that. But that is such a powerful thing when we actually see someone that we're very close to, that we love so very much, in a place of suffering, and we can see how we can help. And that really kicks things off. And then now, and then it's like, once we do help somebody, we're ready to take on the world, right?
We could do it with one. We could do it with 1,000.
There you go. That's so awesome and so inspiring too. So Katie, where can people find you? Where are you at on social media? How can people find you to learn more about what you do and go deeper with you?
Sure. So just look up my name, Katie Papo, on social media. You can also go to katiepapo.com on my website. If you go to katiepapo.com/masterclass on my website, that's where I really dive into the 5 shifts. We talked about one today, but if you really want the full picture, this is where we really go into the 5 shifts that are necessary to kind of put all together to end binge eating permanently.
That's fantastic. Okay. So katiepapo.com/masterclass. That's so awesome. So one final thought from you, Katie, before we say goodbye, I'm really wanting to hear, and I know listeners are too, what's your vision of our future? I mean, right now we're in very, very uncertain times. This is something that we have never experienced here, you know, in this, you know, generation, right? You know, and the generations that are here and now and watching what's going on in the world with the virus, you know, so as far as your vision for when we come out of the other side of this And what does that look like? You know, animals, planet, people, everything.
I think one of the things that an epidemic can do that's actually very positive is it helps people look at their lives in a way they haven't seen it before. When we're faced with crisis or difficulty, we start asking ourselves difficult questions. We start asking ourselves, what are the things that really matter to me? Am I living my life the way I want to be living it? Am I using my time and my energy the way I want to be using them? Am I living aligned with who I am and my purpose? These are the questions that a lot of people ask themselves in a time of crisis. And that's one thing that can be really beautiful, because then when we're out the other side, we have this clarity, then we're ready to make the moves to create that life for ourselves.
Yes, that's incredibly powerful. Love it. All right, Katie. So thank you so very much for joining us today. It's been really incredible having you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you like the show, be sure to hit that subscribe button on your podcast player and leave us a review on iTunes. Those reviews go a really, really long way in helping us to reach more people who would really like to hear what we dish about on this show. So thank you so very much for participating in that. And follow Eating Like You Give a Damn on Instagram and on Facebook for show updates. Also, don't forget to join our community of rebels in the Eating Like You Give a Damn Facebook group. You can find that link and more over at eatinglikeyougiveadamn.com. Thanks so much for hanging out with me and Katie today. And until next time, veg on, rebels.